In the talk, Can We Find Beauty in Tax Fraud, he will which is the first of two talks right after each other, which talk about tax fraud, Martin will take us on a journey through the world of large-scale financial crime and tax fraud and enlighten us on how the public, so all of us, was defrauded out of 64 billion euros. Martin, the stage is yours.
So a warm welcome from my side as well. It's great to be here. My name is Martin. I'm an information security researcher. In a previous life, I've spent a few years working on the technical side of investigative journalism with one of the major networks. Let's start by looking at the past activities here at CCC. Often, it's about creativity. It's about finding unintended uses of systems. It's about exploiting loopholes in complex frameworks. What I'm here to tell you is, whether it's in code or in law, the mindset is surprisingly similar. I'll take you on a quick tour through the shady world of large-scale tax fraud, financial crime, money laundering, and corruption. We'll examine financial exploits, the key fraud actors and enablers, as well as their methods and playbooks. This will be done by using insights from journalists, activists, and investigators over the last few decades. But before we go on this tour, there's a simple question that needs to be asked. Is there beauty in tax fraud? To answer this, we have to take a step back. What is beauty? Let's gain a better understanding of this by examining things that are widely agreed upon as being beautiful. Most people would agree upon that the painting of Mona Lisa is beautiful. Or at least most people can be pressured into submitting to this belief. To properly get to the bottom of this, we need more examples. Maybe we need something abstract. Take a look at it. What do you see? What do you feel? Is it beautiful? These are some of the notes of Beethoven's Ninth. Whilst Mona Lisa might have some inherent real beauty, the second picture, that of the notes of Beethoven's Ninth, probably just is a representation of something that holds real beauty. I would argue that once properly understood, once one can read the notes, the beauty becomes apparent. So it appears there is something as an abstract representation of beauty. Let's get back to taxes. What do you see here? I'll give you 5 seconds. Did you feel the beauty? Or do we somehow at least sense that there is something like that has abstract beauty in here? In case you're wondering, these are also dividend stripping diagrams. Still no beauty? Maybe more examples. Take another look. Breathe in, breathe out. Can you feel it? It's another dividend stripping diagram. Admittedly, the colors are somewhere between questionable and atrocious. But at least the font doesn't Comic Sans. So, could you see it? Was it beautiful? Are you still in awe by the experienced beauty? Are you impressed by the artistic expression? By all the nuances, whether from the artist, from the lawyer, from the fraudster who crafted these schemes? If not, if you could not feel the beauty, don't worry, we can fix that. Okay, back to the promised tour through the shady and exciting world of large-scale tax fraud. Let's explore the hidden beauty, the poetic ingenuity, and the comical blunt stupidity of humanity's nearly 5,000-year-long struggle with taxation. Short disclaimer time. I will partially be a bit loose with terms. I will interchangeably use the term tax fraud, tax optimization, creative accounting, and sometimes even money laundering. The reason for this is simple. Most large-scale tax fraud is intertwined with money laundering, making it hard to tell where one ends and where the other begins. After all, you need to wash those criminal proceedings somehow. The money does not wash itself. But also, distinguishing between legal and illegal feels futile in a world where laws can't be bought. But more on this later. And I also might be portraying a few people as somewhat stupid and maybe simple. This is largely due to survivorship bias. I can only tell you the stories of the criminals that got caught. The smarter ones, they're probably still out there somewhere, scheming in the unknown. At least for today, I have no personal feelings about people paying or not paying taxes. There's no scope for this today. We'll now look at our first case of financial crime. We'll be examining the mechanisms that allowed the fraud to succeed or to fail. All frauds that we will look at represent our own different class of trickery, our own exploit category, if you will. Our first exhibit is the Russian or the Troika laundromat. They're both a bit tricky. In essence, billions of euros of dark money were moved from Russia to Europe, arriving as legitimate funds. Transferring via IBAN, SWIFT, or via bank transfer was not an option because the funds originate from crime and corruption. This means they have to be reintegrated into the financial system, so they need to be laundered, that they can be put into legitimate investments, else they will be seized by authorities. Notable methods used in these schemes. The Troika, but also the Russian laundromat, used a whole family of diverse misdirection and obfuscation tactics to bypass checks and regulations. One of the many bypass techniques I like to think of as corrupt judges as a transport and AML bypass layer. AML stands for anti-money laundering. We will look at what this means in a few moments. The step-by-step process for the exploit is as follows. You set up shell companies in Russia and Moldova. Next, your shell companies create fictitious debt between themselves. Then, a Moldovan judge orders the Russian company to pay the fake debt to a court-controlled account at some Moldovan bank. The Russian company complies with the court order and deposits the funds into the court-controlled accounts. Finally, about 8 billion USD is withdrawn from these accounts and moved worldwide into legitimate funds. Hereby, the laundering is completed. Another technique used in these schemes, I like to think of as financial onion routing via shell companies in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, with Nordic and Central European banks as exit nodes. Think of onion routing as multi-layered routing that obfuscates the original source and the destination. This works as follows. You create thousands of shell companies over multiple jurisdictions. Next, you set up a complex network to route the money in circular patterns, making it harder to be traced. Finally, you move the funds in small chunks through multiple layers, eventually ending up in the EU. About the damage. According to what sources you want to go with, the Russian and the Troika laundromat before 2012 amounted to somewhere between 20 and 90 billion USD. Later in 2018, prosecutors named a sum of 200 billion. Apparently, these 200 billion had been laundered also 2007 and following. It just took more than 10 years for this to surface. This time, the fraud was titled Danzig Bank Scandal. We know all this in part because of various data leaks, human leaks, but also insiders that later confessed when they wanted out. One of the leaks included over 1 million bank transfers that was analyzed by journalists. Some of the witnesses and whistleblowers have either been murdered or have found dead shortly before their court appearances. But why does this all even work? In short, with sufficient generated confusion, checks are known to fail. It can be speculated upon whether the banks had in their own interest for the legally required anti-money laundering regulations to fail. Another way of saying this is, sometimes you can bypass KYC and AML with shell companies. So what is AML, what is KYC, and what are shell companies? Have you ever had to show your passport for proof of identity and had to show some utility bills for proof of residence when opening a bank account? That was probably KYC. KYC stands for Know Your Customer. It's the bank's obligation to verify clients' identity and residence in order to prevent fraud. AML stands for Anti-Money Laundering. These are laws and regulations designed to, just as the name would suggest, to prevent money laundering. For example, you can't just deposit and cross borders with large sums of money without proving some form of legitimate source for these funds. Usually about 10,000 USD is the upper limit. Shell companies, or also shelf companies, are legal entities that exist only on paper, often used to hide ownership of assets. Shell companies can be bought from so-called formation agents. They're often registered in jurisdictions that have weak transparency laws and don't take KYC serious. Then the difference between shell and shelf companies is as follows. Shelf companies are a pricier version of a shell company. Think of them like old wine. They have been created and left untouched for years to appear more legitimate, then used when needed. It's basically just a shell company with a longer shelf life. So what are the consequences of these laundromats? Just recently, Danske Bank paid 2 billion USD in fines for what their Estonian subsidiary did. In the case of Deutsche Bank, one of the main banks involved, they paid about 500 million for negligence in the EU and 7 billion for a settlement agreement in the USA. Apart from that, the consequences of these crimes are that criminals get richer because they can move their proceeds from crime into legitimate investments. Another side effect of this is that moving billions into an economy as dumb investments will significantly inflate the housing market. Our next exhibit is a form of tax office fraud. It's commonly known as identity theft refund fraud. As the name would suggest, fraudsters perform identity theft to exploit and steal from the tax office or from you. This particular fraud is mostly a problem in the USA, primarily due to weak authentication and broken credential reset mechanisms. How is it done? It starts with identity theft. First, criminals steal personal information, such as social security numbers, through email phishing, through paper phishing, or via data breaches. Often there is a form of division of labor that you can observe. Criminals will buy data sets on the black markets. Next, they use the stolen information to impersonate the victim, submitting a fraudulent tax return to the tax office that claims a large refund based on preemptively paid taxes. Finally, the refund is paid out by the tax office into a bank account controlled by the fraudsters. Usually, there is some kind of money mooling involved to siphon the money out of the country. Who exactly is liable for the damages depends on a case-to-case basis. Our next exhibit is the Moldovan bank fraud scandal. In essence, this fraud is about the process of stealing approximately 1 billion euro from Moldova's three biggest banks. You might be wondering, since when is robbing a bank considered tax fraud? It becomes tax fraud when you steal so much that it amounts to 12% of the GDP. Like, someone will need to pay up, and it won't be the banks. It works as follows. You take out fake loans. Next, you use these loans to create fake investments with fake returns, and then again, you use these to secure bigger loans. Now you repeat step two until you have accumulated about 1 billion in bad debt. Next, you transfer the money into foreign investments. Lastly, you continue the money until it becomes untraceable. Now all you have to do is to disappear. Enough about Moldova and Russia. Let's look at some domestic stuff, some stuff in the EU. Let's have a look at two different types of VAT fraud. Simple VAT fraud and a family of missing trader inter-community fraud. In its least complicated form, VAT fraud can be as simple as this. A company imports goods that have a high VAT and declares them as having a low VAT. Think import mobile phones, but actually declare them as cucumbers. In a more extreme form, you simply do not declare the goods at all. Apparently, having corrupt or negligent customs personnel on your payroll can be of help. VAT fraud in praxis is usually more complicated. Missing trader inter-community fraud is one of the most damaging VAT frauds in the EU. In 2018, the European Commission estimated the annual value lost to MTIC fraud in the EU to be somewhere between 20 and 100 billion euros. In 2021, a paper by the European Parliament mentions the figure of 60 billion euros. Note, normally when a company buys a product from another company in the same country, they would directly pay VAT. However, when you buy from a company in another European country, you don't pay the VAT to the seller. Instead, you pay the VAT directly to your government's tax office, albeit with some time delay. The very basic process is as follows. The so-called missing trader imports goods VAT-free from another European country. The importer sells the goods domestically, charging VAT to the buyer. Three, instead of paying the VAT to the tax office, the missing trader disappears with the money. This is the step that puts the missing into the word missing trader. The goods are sometimes re-exported, repeating the fraud in a cycle. The paper by the European Commission mentions the main versions of this fraud being as these: MTIC acquisition fraud, MTIC carousel fraud, MTIC cross-invoicer fraud, MTIC contra trading fraud, MTIC triangular VAT fraud, MTIC fictitious intra-community VAT fraud. Looking briefly at the differences between these frauds, it becomes clear why they pose a challenge for the tax office to detect before the trader gets missing. All graphics that I'll be using I borrowed from the aforementioned paper by the European Commission. MTIC variant acquisition fraud. In this variant, unlike in the previous explained base method, the goods are offloaded to an end consumer, not to a third party that would reclaim the VAT, meaning it becomes more difficult to detect because there is no need for a VAT reclaim. Here in the carousel fraud version, instead of supplying the goods and services to a final customer, the supplies are sold back to the original supplier in another member state. The cross-invoicer scheme is another form of MTIC fraud. In this case, the missing trader, that's the cross-invoicer, does not immediately disappear, but rather uses the fictitious invoice from a false supplier to deduct the charged VAT in order to reduce the VAT payment to the tax authority. The domestic supply is typically a fictitious invoice, and delivery is made from a fake company or from a hijacked company. The contra trading scheme is a complex scheme in which various transaction chains are introduced to make the VAT fraud more difficult to detect by tax authorities. The triangular version involves invoices across three member states, but the goods only pass through two. The variants appear endless. It would seem to be a cat and mouse game between the EU and organized crime groups. Our next exposition is the FDP Mövenpick Gesetz. What we're describing here is legal. It has been criticized as a method for companies to reduce their VAT liabilities. Here's what happened. Someone donated 1.1 million euros to a political party that was in control of the Ministry of Finance. Apparently completely unrelated to the donation, a law was passed that reduces the VAT from 19 to 7% for their sector. Lastly, you keep the prices for your services unchanged and thereby have 12% more profit margin. In essence, this raises the question of whether companies in Germany can legally buy a law that allows them to pay less taxes. To be precise, the donation was made by a subsidiary of the corporation owned by the main shareholder of the hotel chain, not directly by Mövenpick. Next, we want to look at one of the most notorious tax frauds of all time. It's called CumCum or CumEx, also known as dividend stripping. They're a family of tax fraud schemes centering around false tax returns and dividends. They're notable not only because of the huge damage that they caused, which is estimated to be about 150 billion euros worldwide, 62 billion in Europe, 35 billion in Germany, 16 billion in France, followed by Italy and Denmark. CumEx is also noteworthy because of it being financial crime which is committed by banks. There are many ways how this fraud took place, and if we're really lucky, the speaker after me will explain to us in detail how this works. Apparently, the fraud has evolved over the years, but the basic form stays the same. The fraudulent entity colludes with other fraudsters to create duplicate withholding tax certificates. In its simplest form, CumEx is a trade fraud scheme exploiting loopholes in dividend taxation systems. To understand how it works, we need three simple principles. Dividend tax reclaims. Governments often withhold taxes on dividends, but certain investors can reclaim these taxes with proof of ownership. Confusion of ownership is created with shares that are traded around the dividend payment date, often through short selling, creating uncertainty about who owns the shares. Duplicate claims. Both the original owner and the short seller claim refunds for the same tax withheld. This results in multiple tax returns for a single tax payment, thereby defrauding the government. The step-by-step process is as follows. 1. Investor A owns shares in company X worth 20 million euros. 2. Investor C sells shares worth 20 million euros to investor B without owning them herself via short selling. 3. Investor A receives a dividend payout of 750,000 euros, that's the total minus the dividend taxes. After payout, investor A's shares are now only worth 19 million euros. 4. Investor A receives a tax certificate to reimburse the 250,000 of dividend taxes. 5. Investor A sells shares worth 19 million euros to investor C. 6. Investor C delivers the shares worth 19 million euros to investor B and pays her an additional 750,000 euros. 7. Investor B sells shares worth 19 million euros back to investor A. 8. Investor B receives the tax certificates to reimburse the 250,000 of dividends. Investor A, B, and C share the tax reimbursements. I'll give you 20 seconds to digest all of this. So if you haven't fully understood it yet, don't feel too bad about it. It took the government more than 20 years to fix. It's a bit murky when exactly this all began. Apparently, the trades begin somewhere in the early 90s. In 2002, the fraud was mentioned in a warning letter by the German Banking Association that it sent to its members. In 2012, the loophole was officially pronounced closed. In 2021 and later again in 2024, the German Federal Court ruled that CumEx should be considered tax evasion, thereby illegal. In 2021, a financial watchdog, an NGO, voiced concerns whether the loopholes are really closed. I mean, I don't know. But now let's end on a local note. If you would look in this direction, just 1,100 meters or something, southeast from here, there's this small traditional bank. It's also our last exhibit. It's MM Warburg. It's from the city of Hamburg. Like most banks in Germany, it was busy in the 90s and 2000s defrauding the government via dividend stripping. This means it was busy requesting tax reimbursements for taxes that they never paid. But what we want to talk about right now is, once again, it's not fraud, but it's way better than fraud. It's how you legally get away with fraud even after you've been caught, convicted, and fined by a court. The step-by-step process is as follows. You do some financial crime, you get caught doing so. Next, you get legally convicted and fined by a court. 3. Step 3 is really important, pay attention. Don't pay the fine. Step 4, I don't exactly know what happens. Maybe one day we'll find out. 5, the statute of limitations runs out, leading us to 6, direct profit. Now you own 47 million euros more than before. Now you might say, clearly something might be missing or must be missing here. And I would probably agree, it feels that way. What it is, I don't know. One seemingly unrelated event to all of this was that the subsidiary of the Find Bank donated 45,500 euros to the ruling party in the federal state, led at that time by Olaf Scholz. Was Warburg's donation to the SPD related to the fine ever being paid? That's for courts to decide. What we do know is that one of the other politicians who met with the Warburg officials was found to have 210,000 euros in a bank locker. Strangely, they initially denied meeting the Warburg bank officials and only changed the position when the notebook of an involved banker was allowed as evidence in court. Similarly, Olaf Scholz initially denied ever having met the bank officials. Later, after calendar evidence surfaced, Olaf updated his story, admitting to the meeting, but didn't remember the discussion. To summarize the last 25 minutes, the fraud variants appear endless. We didn't have time to discuss how the Pakistani bank BCCI was caught advertising to the Colombian Medellin cartel about how they want to launder their money in Panama. We also didn't have time to discuss how the Malayan 1MDB fraud happened and how blue IKEA bags were used to hold millions in stolen funds. Apparently, about 2 million USD fit in a blue IKEA bag. Who would have thought? Similarly, 30 minutes are too short to discuss how the fine art market in New York City and London is seen as one of the last bastions of unregulated commerce, where you're not responsible from and to whom you're selling and buying from, and thus was just used in 2021 to move money that was later used to finance terrorists or freedom fighters, depending how you want to see it. As we have seen, different crime actors exploit the financial system and engage in financial crime for a variety of reasons. Some do it directly for profit. Others, such as truck traffickers, use it to launder the proceeds of other crimes. Meanwhile, some pursue geopolitical goals, financing wars, terrorism, or anything in between by circumventing sanctions and funding illicit activities. The methods these actors employ are as varied as a botanical garden. Some are crude, exploiting thresholds or chaining transactions through proxy companies. Others involve corrupt officials, judges, and politicians who abuse their power to enable laundering. Some schemes appear deceptively clever, and the most ingenious ones, they're probably still out there in the unknown. Much like in any complex ecosystem, and for me at least the most interesting, there lies beyond the laundering participants an entire ecosystem of enablers who thrive in their parasitic niches. These enablers range from criminal service providers who offer their supposedly untraceable shell companies and bank accounts with fictitious directors, all the way to established law firms advertising on tax optimization strategies. Even some German law professors play a dual role. On the one hand, paid consultants of scheming banks, and on the other hand, advisors to the government tasked with fixing the loopholes. So back to our original question. Back to why we're here. So can we find beauty in tax fraud? I'm going to end this not with my own words, but with the words of someone who's probably way better suited to answer this question. Can we find beauty in tax fraud? I don't know, and I don't recall.
Thank you very much for this talk. We still have a few minutes for a short Q&A. If you have any questions, you can go to the microphones. We have 4 microphones down here, 2 over there, and 2 on the upper floor. And a short reminder, the queue in Q&A is for question, not for comment. So please limit your questions. Do we have a question from the internet? Then microphone one.
Is there a way to read more about your work somewhere?
Yes. So basically everything I said is well established and has been published by multiple news outfits. So I avoided to say anything that has just been published by one or two outfits. So basically, really every single sentence I said is absolutely well known.
I meant, like, do you publish your work somewhere? Like,
No.
Okay.
No.
Thanks.
Then microphone six.
Thank you for the talk. When you are doing tax fraud involving banks, you need an identity to put on the bank account, right? And if it's small amounts, I guess you can just use some homeless person or something who you have bribed with a few hundred euros. But what about large amounts? Don't you need, like, rich people? Who are the sort of people who are accepting these jobs when they're using their real identities?
So I guess this depends on the jurisdiction, and there's quite a few of them.
Thank you.
Then microphone one.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. Maybe I just missed it in the beginning, but what is your definition of beauty? And also, what do we gain, in your opinion, if we look at this multifaceted phenomena from an aesthetic perspective?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I think I'll pass on it, actually.
Then microphone two.
Yeah, hello, great talk. I just wanted to ask, how is it possible that essentially scams like Cum-Ex were legal before 2021? So you said it was like illegalized, but this means two companies getting tax returns for the same thing was legal before, and how is that possible?
That's a great question, and I'd love to understand this better. We're very lucky here. The speaker after me knows everything about this, and if we're lucky, they will explain in detail.
Thank you.
Microphone one.
Well, you saw in the Panama Papers also that these shell companies are key to hide the money and the real ultimate owners. So do you see any chances of better know your customer procedures or forcing these countries like Panama, Cyprus, Malta, whatever, to be more transparent and disclose the ultimate owners?
That's an interesting question. My personal feeling, but this isn't fact-based, is that the number of tax havens is becoming less, but the amount of laundered money is becoming more. So there is definitely a big pressure on drying up tax havens.
Microphone three.
Thank you. I always wonder why do parties or politicians accept amounts of money that are so small in comparison to what, in effect, they are enabling to launder?
So in the case, like we saw, what was that, 47 million profits versus 45,000 in donations, which would be a factor of 1,000, probably. So, you know, there was also money found in bank lockers. Who knows if this money is related? Who knows what other bank lockers were not opened? But, yeah.
Okay, I don't see any more people standing on the microphone, but there is a question from the internet.
The internet would like to know, do consultants appear in public media in Germany?
Can you repeat that?
Do consultants appear on public media in Germany?
I guess that depends on the consultant. I'm not sure if I understand, but thank you.